In this episode of Cube FM, you better get ready to get hooked on webhooks, because that's what we'll be talking about with our guest, Gordon Myers. Gordon explains how webhooks play a crucial role in Kubernetes API interactions. He also delves into JSON patching and emphasizes the significance of thorough testing for webhooks, which is critical to avoid deployment failures. Gordon also draws parallels between aspect-oriented programming and webhooks, addressing challenges and security risks in webhook implementation. This episode is sponsored by LearnK8s. We all know that learning Kubernetes can be complicated, so you have access in LearnK8s through online training as well as in person. The courses are 60% practical and 40% theoretical that are being done both online and in person. For more information, check out learnk8s.io. Now, let's get into the episode. All right, Gordon. So can you tell me which three emerging Kubernetes tools you're keeping an eye on?
Good question. So the first one I would not say is emerging, but I just had to mention it because it's so critical to day-to-day operations. That's K9S. I think really anyone doing anything with Kubernetes, you know, it's table stakes. You need to have it. But then also maybe not so much emerging either, but Kubeflow is a collection of utilities to kind of help develop the entire MLOps lifecycle. It has, you know, components in it, like the Kubeflow workflows is actually just a wrapper around Argo workflows, which is great for data engineering, container-based workflows. And then there's Jupyter notebooks that are hosted in the cluster and a host of other things. So Kubeflow is a fantastic. And a newer one that is actually emerging, I'm keeping an eye on, I think it's still fairly immature. A colleague introduced me to a GitHub project called KRS, or Kubetools Recommender System, that basically leverages LLMs to take a look at your logs and check the health of things. I was playing around with it last night, and it started hallucinating a bunch of things, so I think it's still fairly immature, but I'm keeping an eye on it because it's interesting.
And can you explain about a little bit more to our audience about who are you, you know, what do? Where do you work?
Yeah, so I'm Gordon Myers, a software engineer, has been in the industry for 15, 16 years now. You've actually caught me at a very interesting inflection point, because until recently, I did work for a, let's say, medium-sized American insurance company. And the particular company is not that important, but the department in which I led was called the Data Science and Analytics Lab, or we abbreviate that as DSAL. And it was really quite a privilege. We were an innovation lab that was chartered to look at the future of insurtech, trying to answer the question, you know, how does our business stay relevant and competitive 10, 20, 30 years from now? And to that end, we were given a lot of latitude to experiment and innovate and push the envelope with new technologies. So we were the first in the organization to be in the cloud. We were the first to use Kubernetes and a host of other firsts. Unfortunately, the department was recently let go. And so I am actively interviewing with several other companies right now. But for the purposes of today's conversations, I'll kind of focus on my experience at that group, because I was there for over 6 years.
Okay. Now, how did you get into cloud native?
Yeah. So just quickly going through the thread of my career, I started in 2008 working for a web development firm doing PHP development. And cloud native was not really a thing that widespread at the time. And so I did that for a number of years, and the deployment, which I'm sure we'll talk about, looked very different in that world than it does now. Later went to work for a startup, and where we were starting to get a little more into it, we leveraged tools like Elastic Beanstalk to deploy WAR files. But then when I came to work for DSAL, I was already joining a crowd that had started doing that to a great extent. They containerized all of our applications. But when I joined, we were still using Amazon ECS to deploy everything. But in that spirit I was talking about of experimentation, we quickly, you know, took an eye on Kubernetes and realized, oh, this is a much superior platform. And it's kind of gained a ton of industry adoption and traction, and the community support for it is fantastic. And so the whole team was kind of upskilled together to say, we're going to go all in on Kube, and have never looked back since.
And, you know, deciding to go all in, it's no joke, right? I mean, it's an ecosystem that moves very quickly.
Yes.
In your experience, how do you stay updated with all the changes going on in the Kubernetes and cloud native ecosystem? Is it through blogs, podcasts, videos? What works best for you?
It's kind of all of the above. So I do like attending tech conferences, or, you know, watching the videos of them later, perhaps. Meetup groups are also a great resource where you have others who have, you know, had that battle experience to share, you know, their wounds and advice. And then tech blogs here and there, yes. But I would say in general, though, I am an experiential learner. And so I do best when I'm trying it out myself.
Last but not least, if you could go back and give one career tip to your younger self, what would it be?
Yeah, great question. I think it would be to attend more meetup groups. Like, I'm a naturally somewhat introverted, shy person, and so I didn't do a lot of that until recent years. And it's just being around other engineers who have experimented with it or are experimenting with things. It is just a really enriching environment. And so I would encourage my younger self to make more friends, essentially.
As part of our monthly content discovery, we found this article, Kubernetes Webhooks Explained. So the questions we're going to be asking are related to that. Before we dive into webhooks, let's talk about how the Kubernetes API works. Can you walk us through the life cycle of a request in Kubernetes from when it's received to when it's stored in its CD?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Kubernetes API, you can access it in a number of different ways. If you're using a command line tool like kubectl, that's going to be using the Kubernetes API under the hood, or if it's just a deployment that you're releasing through Helm, same thing. So it kicks off with authentication. The request that you're making is going to be authenticated. So if you've ever looked at your kubeconfig file, there's probably, you know, a long hex string in there that called client certificate data and client key data. It's using that to identify who you are and verify that you have the right to talk to this server in the first place. Once that's validated, it will then go through an authorization flow. So Kubernetes has a role-based access control that can say, you know, this person can do these things. And so your request is going to be validated that not only you are who you say you are, but that you're allowed to do the things that you're requesting to do. Finally, it will pass through a series of admission controllers. And so that's, I think, what we're going to focus on today, because webhooks come into play as admission controllers. You've got two different types of webhooks, which we'll get into, I'm sure. And then finally, once all that handshake is completed, it will then persist the data in etcd, which, as you pointed out, is the persistent data store that Kubernetes uses under the hood.
For folks out there that maybe aren't super familiar with Kubernetes webhooks, could you just give a quick explanation of what they are? And can you provide an example of how they might be used?
Absolutely. So a webhook is essentially a listener function that will receive a pod specification when you're trying to launch or update the pod. And so for the users not familiar, a pod is essentially just a container, an application that you're running that can be either a long-lived web service or a run-to-completion job. And when you launch that container, it has its own definition, which you've probably defined in a Docker file. But the two types of webhooks, there's validating webhooks and there's mutating webhooks. And the validating ones will take a look at the pod that you're trying to launch and will say, yes or no, are you allowed to launch this pod based on whatever proprietary logic you've come up with in that webhook? Or the mutating one will take a look at the pod specification and say, well, before this launches, let's make a couple of last minute changes to it, again, based on whatever logic you define. So it's all kind of user-defined interactions in a consistent way using webhook listeners.
So when a resource is submitted to the API, it's eventually sent to the webhook. How does this
right.
work? And what should the response from the webhook be?
Yeah, so the resource definitions in Kubernetes, and in my blog post, I frequently refer to them as DOM objects. And by that, I simply mean it's a declarative YAML language. It's declarative in the same sense that HTML or CSS is declarative. Like the object definitions for Kubernetes don't inherently do anything themselves. So you'll say, here's my deployment, and it'll say, run this container image, maybe with these environment variables, these secrets, you know, on and on. And the webhook will receive that same definition. It's not the application itself. It's just kind of metadata about the application that's about to be run. Typically, that's represented in YAML syntax when you're defining objects for Kubernetes. YAML is mostly isomorphic with JSON, meaning you can translate back and forth from one to the other. That's not completely true, but I won't get into the edge cases. And so what happens with the Kubernetes webhook configurations is when you are trying to launch a pod, it will send the JSON representation of that pod to your webhook function as a post request, as part of the post body. And then your function has the opportunity to inspect that and determine, you know, like I said, if it's a validating webhook, whether or not it wants to admit that pod, or if it's a mutating one, if it wants to actually modify that pod definition. And so it's taking that JSON definition and changing it, mutating it.
With the topic of JSON coming up, let's dive a little bit deeper into JSON patching. How does that work in the context of Kubernetes webhooks? And could you also provide an example there?
Yeah, so Kubernetes is great for using a lot of standards. And one of the standard formats that it uses in the webhook configurations is the standard called JSON patch. I think there's actually like an ISO number definition for it. I don't remember that number, but JSON patch is a, you know, industry accepted standard for defining how you would manipulate a JSON object into another JSON object. And it does that with essentially three operations. I'm struggling to remember. I think there's add. Let me look up my own blog post. Okay, add, remove, and replace. Yep. And at each path, dot notation path within your JSON, you can say, I want to, you know, if you've got a JSON list nested in your object, I want to add an entry to this list. Or if you have a, you know, key value somewhere in your JSON, you say, I want to replace this value with something else. And so it provides a set of concrete, discrete operations you can perform. You just list out these operations as, you know, add here, replace here, remove here. And then that is what your webhook returns to the server. Maybe you're going to get at this, but as I hint in my blog post, the particular way in which you encode that response, I found to be a little bit janky and unexpected.
It seems like testing is a crucial aspect when implementing webhooks. And why is thorough testing so important in this context?
Let me tell you a little bit about the application that I actually wrote and detailed in my blog post, because I think this will lead into that question perfectly. So we wrote a webhook to take secret values from HashiCorp Vault, which we had deployed in our environment, and inject them dynamically in memory, not having to rely on Kubernetes secrets themselves. Now, when we built this, this was prior to Mac Chaffee writing his, you know, blog post about how secrets are actually fine. But, you know, we were a little bit concerned that you've got these base64 encoded secrets. We're already using Vault. We might as well leverage it and just come up with a way to inject those directly into the running application. And so we wrote an application that does that, where you just specify an annotation on the pod to say, essentially, here's the path in Vault that I want you to retrieve secrets from. And then when the application launches, it injects a special entry point script that we had developed, which will then launch your intended entry point as a subprocess, but do so with the secrets as environment variables. So all well and good, great idea. But what we found is that there are so many pitfalls, there are so many places where this can go awry, because if your webhook returns a 500 error, the pod that you were intending to launch doesn't launch. So it really needs to be battle tested and solid. And so when you're developing these webhooks, it's really important that you hit as many unit test cases as you can. I think in development, it's common to, you know, flesh out some unit tests, but, you know, you've got to ship products, so it's not always the priority focus. But when it comes to webhooks in particular, just because it has such far-reaching implications for the rest of your stack, that's the part that you want to test the most.
In a previous episode, interesting that you mentioned the blog post by Mac as well too regarding secrets. In a previous episode, two of our guests, Tybalt and Miguel, used a custom mutating webhook to change the container image architecture and deploy the workloads on ARM nodes. They suffered an outage when the webhook timed out. What kind of advice would you share in those scenarios?
Yeah, when the webhook timed out, that's a really interesting application. It's so fun seeing the creative ideas that people come up with webhooks. I extend my sympathy to them, because I certainly had cases in my job where, you know, other engineers were trying to launch pods and there was some error that I hadn't foreseen in the webhook, and it just kind of grinds things to a halt, and then you have to really focus on that quick. Like I said, just trying to plan ahead and think of every, you know, different scenario. In that particular case, I wonder if you can fall back to just temporarily disabling the webhook while you're debugging, and then maybe just, you know, changing your deployment specs manually to use the ARM architecture instead. But it's something that's really hard to foresee, so my heart goes out to those guys.
In your article, you drew a parallel between webhooks and aspect-oriented programming, AOP. Before we address that, what is AOP, and can you give an example of when you would use it?
Yeah, absolutely. So aspect-oriented programming, AOP, is this concept that was developed in the 90s in the Java community originally, and it was about taking common sort of cross-cutting concerns in your application code and abstracting them to a simpler annotation-based aspect layer. And so in the blog post, I gave the example of Spring Security, which is a popular framework that works with Java Spring Boot and allows you to just, you know, set those Java annotations where you say, I want this function to be authorized. Or there are ways you could use aspects to define, you know, common logging traits. And just taking any cross-cutting concern where you would otherwise be re-implementing very similar logic across different concerns and allowing you to separate that concern to use a system that's annotation-based. Kubernetes I thought, really naturally supports this paradigm because it has a system of annotations built in. When you're defining your deployment spec or your pod spec, there is a field there, not only for labels, which you mentioned earlier, but also for annotations. And by providing those annotations, normally they don't do anything, right? They're just like a piece of text decorating your deployment. You can search for them. But webhooks are what really give power to that system because when you're inspecting that JSON definition of your pod coming in, you can look for certain annotations. And if they're present, then take action. And that to me is, you know, just perfectly encapsulating what AOP is all about.
And what does AOP have to do with Kubernetes webhooks?
Yeah, so like I said, the power behind the annotations really comes into play with webhooks. So a particular example that I had in my blog post, like I said, where we're taking secrets from HashiCorp Vault, we would begin by specifying an annotation on the pod to say, this is where you need to look in Vault. And then the webhook service would inspect and see, does the pod have this annotation? If so, I'm going to take this action and mutate the pod accordingly. And so that allows us a huge benefit, which is if we had done it the other way, or one of many other ways, we could have just embedded a client to speak to HashiCorp Vault directly into the Docker container. But then your Docker container starts to get more bloated and heavy. And by doing it at this Kubernetes, at the infrastructure layer, that just allows a much cleaner separation of concern.
In your article, you mentioned, and you said previously as well, the podcast, that Kubernetes resources are dumb and don't always provide all the information a webhook might need. Can you elaborate on this challenge and how it affects webhook implementation?
Yeah, so all I meant by that, and again, like I said earlier, it's dumb in the sense that, you know, HTML is dumb or any declarative language is dumb. So the particular objects that are involved in the Kubernetes ecosystem for webhooks are the mutating webhook configuration or validating webhook configuration. And this is just simply a YAML definition. The configuration is actually the easiest part of webhooks. This is just defining, hey, I want, you know, this webhook service located at this URL or this, you know, running service in my cluster to run anytime a pod is updated or created or, you know, whatever you configure it to be. And so the object that you're deploying with your Helm chart to define the webhook isn't inherently doing anything of itself. It's just telling Kubernetes where to look. The real heavy lifting takes place in the web service that you're running. And that's the web service where it's going to be receiving that JSON body representing all of your pods and then potentially mutating them. And that web service, you know, the sky's the limit. You can write that in Go. You can write that in Python. You can write that in Fortran if you hate yourself. You know, whatever you want to do. It's just an ordinary web service. But it's hooked into the ecosystem by means of that configuration object, but the configuration object itself isn't really doing anything. It's your service that's doing the actual action, the imperative code.
you know, having gone through all this, are there any pitfalls that developers of webhooks should be aware of?
Yeah. So besides the fact that you need to get everything completely well battle tested because there's so many areas where it could be awry, one thing that I discovered is that in my particular case, I was writing a webhook that would modify the entry point of the running container. Funny enough, the entry point is not always visible to Kubernetes when you are launching your pod, because oftentimes that entry point is defined in the Docker file and you're just going with whatever is the default entry point there. So when you receive this, when your webhook service receives this JSON definition of the pod, it'll say, run this image with these environment variables, but I don't know what it's doing. I'm not going to know until we launch it. And so to overcome that, you then have to make your webhook service smart enough to be able to connect to the container registry and essentially perform a Docker inspect and see, okay, I've received this container image, but what does it do? And then with that call, that additional API call to the container registry, you can then inspect more details of the pod that's trying to launch and then make your adjustments accordingly.
I know we talked a bit previously about, you know, secrets management, but and do webhooks pose any possible security risks?
Yeah, so this is something I've thought a bit about, and the short answer is yes, but I think it's unlikely. So in the Kubernetes community, there's long been talk about, you know, if an attacker has access to your cluster, they're going to spin up pods to perform crypto mining and just burn through your CPU credits and everything. And I actually do think there's been at least one documented piece of malware. I was looking into this last evening called Kinzing that took advantage of a misconfigured cluster to do exactly that. And webhooks, yes, technically could pose a similar risk, because keep in mind, every pod that is being launched through your cluster is first going through the webhook server. And so in theory, an attacker could write a webhook and install it, or perhaps modify an existing webhook to take the web service that you're trying to launch and replace it with their own crypto mining pod, or maybe just launch a sidecar alongside your application to do the same. It is possible. However, the reason I think it's extremely unlikely that attackers are going to reach on the shelf for webhooks as their means of accomplishing that is because there's just much lower hanging fruit that they could take advantage of first. Webhooks are really dang complicated. And I just don't think they're going to go with the most complicated route when, if they already have access to your cluster, they could just simply launch pods directly in some namespace that you're not aware of. And plus, if you're using a webhook and it's modifying the existing pods that you're trying to launch, I think it actually raises the risk to the attacker that you're going to notice what they're doing. Because if you're trying to launch a deployment and your deployment doesn't work because they've supplanted it with some crypto mining scheme, you're not just going to say, okay, well, I guess it doesn't work. You're going to investigate why and then probably immediately discover what's going on.
In terms of your process learning all this, how did you do it? Through sweat and tears, suffering, begging for help? What was it like?
Yeah, great question. As I indicated earlier, I definitely am an experiential learner. And so when I first got started, I installed an instance of Minikube on my MacBook. But then I quickly learned that the memory profile that Minikube took up was noticeable. It was like slowing down other operations. So I ended up going out and purchasing 4 Raspberry Pis, which I installed Kubernetes onto. My first attempt at that was a failure. I tried to just do it with straight kubeadm and it didn't work. Eventually I came around to using K3S, and that was much easier to get onboarded with. And so I have a home lab. I have a cluster of 4 Raspberry Pis in my basement, and I just hit that as needed. In addition to that, I've got the privilege of working with some really talented DevOps engineers who were great mentors and tutors and kind of would guide me when I had the more detailed questions. A lot of trial and error, but also a lot of good mentorship.
Speaking of trial and error and good mentorship, we read that you recently married your best friend and that you're a cat lover. Can you confirm?
I can indeed confirm, yes. So I got married back in July to my girlfriend of 6 years. We're having a great time as newlyweds. And we currently own 7 cats. So it keeps us busy. It's a bit of a zoo.
Any possibility of getting an 8th cat and you could have Kate's cats?
I like the pun. But absolutely not. Like, this is too much as it is. I'm not sure if Jackson Galaxy is one of your regular listeners, but if he is and you're out there, Mr. Galaxy, I could really use your advice on some of these CAD matters. But yeah, seven is enough.
And what's next for you?
So like I said, I'm actively interviewing with a number of companies right now. I also will say I'm hoping to have my next technical blog post out in a matter of hopefully just 2 weeks here. It won't be on Kubernetes this time. I'm writing one on Python. I'm kind of the world's worst blogger. I would say that I'm a lot like the Ents from Lord of the Rings, because when I say something, you know, it takes me a long time to say, but I'm only going to say things if it's worth taking a long time to say. So I think by the Kubernetes blog post you came across and is the subject of this interview, it's like 4,000 words. It just takes me a while.
But you get there. That's the important thing.
I do get there, yes.
If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it?
Good question. I'm on most social media. You can find me on Threads, where I follow a lot of developer folks there. Follow me on GitHub. My GitHub probably doesn't look particularly active, but that's mainly because I have a lot of private repositories. I actually have a secret project I'm working on right now that I'm hoping to make public in the next 6 months. So follow me on Threads or GitHub.
All right. Plenty of action going on there. Thank you very much for putting the blog out as well. We really enjoyed it, and we know our audience will too. Wish you the best of luck in the following steps, marriage and cats alike. And
yes.
Hope our paths cross somewhere in the future. Take care, man.
This was a delight. Thank you very much.
All right. Cheers.